84. The Man Who Shot Walt Disney.
"It's not bad," said Bobby, spilling a little of his second piece of Mojado as he leaned back in his chair to see the top of Big Ed's building through Hollis's helmet. "The scale works."
Inchmail had really had an extraordinary effect on him, Hollis thought. She'd definitely been right about his being an Inchmail fan, but she wouldn't have expected quite this degree of cessation of anxiety, although some of that might be his being 5 days off what she'd come to think of as the money shot, with Gareth and the old man, so she assumed, long gone. Tito, she knew, though entirely by accident, was still here, or had been, just this afternoon. She'd seen him in the mall beneath the Four Seasons, where she'd moved when Big End had arrived from L.A. He'd been with a man who might have been an older brother, with straight, black, center-parted hair to his shoulders. They'd been shopping, to judge by the bags. Tito had seen her, definitely, and had smiled, but then had turned away, down another concourse of heavily trademarked commerce.
"It's the lack of detail that I like," said Inchmail. "Early Disney."
Bobby removed the helmet, brushing his forelock aside.
"That's not Alberto, though. That's because you wanted it yesterday. If you left Alberto on it, he'd skin it up like something out of a horror movie."
He put the helmet on the table. They were outside the bar on Mainland, where she'd first gone with Inchmail and Heidi, the night she'd come back with them.
"These bollards,"
Odile asked, stressing the second syllable. "They have seen it?"
"Just a frame grab," Inchmail said.
He had had the idea when Hollis and Odile told him about Bobby Chombo deserting the locket of artists of L.A. and about Alberto losing his river, of his going to Bobby with a video proposal from the Bollards. The song was called "I'm the Man Who Shot Walt Disney," Inchmail's favorite of the material he was to produce for them in L.A. Bobby would direct, and the video would jump a platform, introducing locative art to a wider audience, while helmets like Hollis's were still in the beta test stage. In order to make certain that Bobby picked up his abandoned obligations in L.A., Inchmail had pretended to be a particular fan of Alberto's. With Odile as go-between, things had come together very quickly, and they'd managed to make it necessary for Bobby to get everyone else's work back up on new servers, which he'd already done. Heidi had gone back to the mysteries of her Beverly Hills marriage, leaving Odile initially disconsolate. Successfully sorting the server issues of at least a dozen artists with Bobby seemed to have taken care of that, though. Hollis assumed that this had afforded the French curator some kind of major status jump, something good to take home. Not that Odile showed any particular desire to do that. She was still living at Big End's, sharing the place with him, while Hollis was at the Four Seasons in the room next to Inchmail's. Bobby's video for the Bollards, with Philip Rausch's enthusiastic approval, had become part of her still unwritten article for Node. She'd decided, after her breakfast at Beanie's, to tell Big End that she'd been held captive, albeit very gently and politely, between leaving Bobby's place and being returned there. It was a scenario that the old man had provided, without intending to. It was what he said they'd do if she were unable to accept his terms. Blindfolded, turned over to an unknown third party, and held at an unknown location until Gareth had returned to take her back to Bobby's. No idea what they had done that night. Since Bobby didn't know exactly what they had done either, and since he hadn't been privy to her agreement with the old man, she didn't have to worry about him telling Big End she was lying. And lying about this to Big End was something she'd decided she just had to do. And Big End, for his part, was making that curiously easy. He seemed, with the advent of his zillion-dollar Chinese car commercial, to have put his foray into the secret world on the back burner, if indeed it was still on the stove. She assumed he'd take advantage of having met Bobby, sooner if not later, and extract whatever bits and pieces of the puzzle Bobby might have, but that was not her business. A part of her business, henceforth, she'd decided, would be to be that chimney brick behind which the old man had chosen to hide the secret of what he'd done. Which apparently was still very much a secret, as nothing at all had appeared anywhere about a truck being seized as it entered Idaho from Canada. They had told her to expect that, though. The whole business had to play out initially in spook country.
and might well remain there for a very long time, and that was why he'd entrusted her with it in the first place.
Ollis, Odile was saying behind her, you must look at Inchmail's Willie.
I don't think so, she said, turning to discover a picture of the beautiful Angelina holding a drooling baby Willie Inchmail on a patio in Buenos Aires. He's bald enough, she said, but where's the beard?
He's mad for percussion, said Inchmail, tossing off the last of his own piso. And tits.
Hollis reached across for the helmet. Soon, very soon, she'd have to give Inchmail her answer on the Chinese car commercial. That was why they were all up here, in this spring that became daily more ridiculously beautiful, rather than in Los Angeles, where Inchmail had his bollards temporarily on hold. He wanted to do it. He was a father now, he said, a provider. And if it took It's Hard to Be One selling Chinese cars to do that, so be it. For her part, she still couldn't say. She put the helmet on, turned it on, and looked up to where Alberto's giant cartoon rendition of the Mongolian death worm, its tail wound through the various windows of Big End's pyramidal airy like an eel through the skull of a cow, waved imperially, tall and scarlet, in the night. This is Robertson Dean. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Spook Country. This program was executive produced by Patty Peruse and produced by Dan Musselman. Spook Country is a production of Penguin Audio, a member of Penguin Group USA, Inc., and Books on Tape. Copyright 2007, all rights reserved. The book, Spook Country, is available wherever G.P. Putnam's Sons books are sold.